From KXJZ in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Coming up in the program, a new book about ethnic cleansing in California during the gold rush. Plus, two local women preparing to swim to Catalina Island and a local man preparing to swim the English Channel. But first, you've probably seen pictures of the bear cub in South Lake Tahoe that was rescued from a wildfire with badly burned paws. We have a couple of pictures on our page, capradio.org/insight. The cub, nicknamed Lil Smokey, is being cared for at an animal charity called Lake Tahoe Wildlife Care. The vet who's treating Lil Smokey's paws is doing something a little unusual. He's using honey on one paw and a more commonly used burn ointment on the others. Why is he doing that, and how is the paw being treated with honey doing? The vet joins us from South Lake Tahoe, Dr. Kevin Willits. Welcome to Insight.
Hi there.
Why did you decide to use honey on one of the bear's paws?
Well, we kind of had a unique situation. We had four burned feet, and honey is not all that out of the world. It's been used for a long, long time, and we were looking to see if we could get better results from one treatment than another. All four of the treatments, including honey, are pretty well accepted as burn treatments.
So you are, in effect, doing an informal test?
Pretty much, yeah. Well, that's what we started out doing. We didn't realize it was going to generate quite as much controversy, but...
Okay. Well, how is the paw that had honey applied to it doing?
About the same. I mean, we have two, the front feet and the back feet. The back feet were burned worse. The two front feet, one of which is being used, the honey is being used on, are virtually the same. And we haven't seen any of the four treatments stand out as that much better to say, oh gosh, let's go use this one all the way, the rest of the way. But by the same token, none of them are doing worse either.
What kind of things are you putting on the other paws?
We're using silver sulfadiazine, we're using hydrocolloid patch, and we're using a nitrofurantoin, a furosin ointment.
Have you used honey before in situations like this?
I've had limited use, but I have read a number of articles and seen a number of lectures on it at different continuing education seminars. In my private practice, we've used it once or twice, and certainly haven't had any negative problems.
Doesn't the stickiness of honey make it a difficult thing to apply to painful burned skin?
No, you would think so, but it doesn't stick to skin and none of these treatments, and that's part of the process, is you're actually trying to wick away any exudate, and none of them actually hold stuff against the skin. So it comes off very easily. It doesn't stick.
We're talking about the honey that's being used to treat one of the burned paws of the bear cub, nicknamed Lil Smokey, at South Lake Tahoe. Joining us is Dr. Kevin Willits, the veterinarian who's caring for the bear cub. We wanted to get another perspective in this, and we found Peter Molan, who's an expert on the use of honey to treat wounds. He's professor in biological sciences and director of the Honey Research Unit at the University of Waikato in Hamilton, New Zealand. He's written scientific papers on the use of honey as a wound dressing. Peter Molan, welcome to Insight.
Thank you very much, and good afternoon to you, Jeffrey.
How useful is honey at treating wounds?
Extremely useful if it's done correctly.
And how do you do it correctly?
You have to keep the honey there. Dr. Willits was mentioning the exudate, the fluid oozing out of a wound. What happens with honey, because it's very water soluble, is it tends to get flushed away by that fluid. So you do need to have some sort of dressing material that will actually hold the honey there, or change it much more frequently otherwise than you would with other wound care products.
And Dr. Willits, you have dressings on Lil Smokey's paws that are changed periodically.
Absolutely, yes. Yeah. We're using Telfa over the top of the honey and to hold it against the wound, and we're changing them at 24-hour intervals. Certainly, in some situations, you would want to do that more frequently, but we're dealing with a wild animal that we have to anesthetize each time, and so we have to judge what's the best interest all the way around.
Peter Molan, what is happening? What is the honey doing? What property is it in the honey that makes it useful in situations like this?
In a situation with burns, the property that's probably having the major beneficial effect is the anti-inflammatory activity. Honey has a potent anti-inflammatory action.
So it reduces the swelling?
Swelling's only part of it, because the whole inflammatory process is very detrimental to healing, as well as causing all of the pain. The inflammation produces substances which sensitize nerve endings to make them much more susceptible to giving sensation of pain.
So it helps reduce the...
The bear probably won't be able to tell you is that one paw may well be hurting less than the other.
So the honey, at least in theory, helps to reduce the feeling of pain.
But it's also by reducing the other effects of inflammation is preventing the inflammation from slowing the healing.
Mm. What about infection? Does honey tackle bacterial infection?
Yes, but again, if you use the do it properly, and in this case it means using the right honey, honeys vary up to 100 times in the potency of their antibacterial activity, and the sort of honey that's most commonly sold in the United States is the clear, liquid, runny honey. And that's been subjected to a lot of heating in the processing to keep it physically like that. And that tends to destroy the antibacterial activity.
So you wouldn't recommend using the most common commercially available honey in the United States for this purpose?
No, I wouldn't.
Yes. Dr. Willits,
there's plenty of unheated honey around if you can get it from beekeepers or farmers' markets or those sorts of places.
Dr. Willits, where are you getting the honey that you're using on Little Smoky?
We're using a raw, unpasteurized honey.
And Peter Mullen, does that, Peter Mullen, does that sound good to you?
Yes, it does. Yeah. There are in the USA now, sold only as medical products, FDA approved. Our wound care products with a New Zealand honey, Manuka, which has a particularly effective antibacterial activity. But if people are wanting first aid use, and particularly if it's immediately after a burn, getting honey on then, any honey, is better than anything else for preventing inflammation from setting in and stopping more damage to the wound, because inflammation will lead to a burn getting worse, getting deeper, because it activates protein-digesting enzymes which digest away the tissue, and you can stop that by getting honey on quickly.
Do bees use honey for healing?
Not as such. They're just feeding on it all the time and feeding the young on it all the time. So whether it's protecting them or not from infection, I don't know. I'm not aware of any research of having been done on that.
Okay. Well, thank you so much. Peter Mullen joins us from New Zealand, the University of Waikato in Hamilton. He's Professor of Biological Sciences there and Director of the Honey Research Unit, and he's written scientific papers on the use of honey as a wound dressing. Peter, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for the opportunity.
Dr. Willits, I'm mainly joking here, but doesn't Little Smokey want to try and lick the honey off his paw even though it's underneath a bandage?
Well, actually, after we put it on the first time, we were a little concerned about that ourselves. We didn't think of that right off the bat, but that hasn't been a problem. He's got plenty of other food available, and it is well covered and well protected, and we haven't had any issues with that.
Very good. Well, let's bring into the conversation Cheryl Milham, who's founder and executive director of Lake Tahoe Wildlife Care, the South Lake Tahoe organization that's caring for bear cub Little Smokey. Cheryl, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
What happens next to Little Smokey?
Well, you should have asked that question to Dr. Willits.
I can certainly answer that. We're still in an evaluation process. Burns take a long time to heal, and we had different degrees of burn over different parts of the feet. And it appears that we're getting some reasonably good healing of the pad tissue. A little too early to tell if it's functional. The toes were damaged more severely, and especially on the back, And it may take weeks to months before we know whether we'll get full regeneration or any regeneration in some of the claws that have been lost. And it's time. A lot of it's time.
So it's not yet known whether the pads on his paws and his claws will grow back enough. But Cheryl, perhaps you can address this. If the pads and claws do grow back, what does Lake Tahoe Wildlife Care then do with Lil Smokey or any other bear cub in this situation?
Well, we do have three other bear cubs now in our care, and what we do is we teach them what they are going to find for food, depending on where Fish and Game tells us they're going to release them. We do the training and the food available, and so when it comes time to go into hibernation, we put them into hibernation, and it's a well-known practice that when a bear cub is in hibernation and put in a den, when he wakes up, he doesn't seem to have any memory of ever being kept in a rehab situation. He's a wild bear.
But you have to teach him how to be a bear.
That's correct.
And is that hard to do?
It's a challenge because you don't want to teach them on a personal basis because you don't want them to get used to humans. So you have to present them with situations that they can learn. Now, bears are a very thinking animal, and so they catch on pretty fast. So sometimes it takes a little while, like first time they're introduced to a walnut or an acorn, they don't understand what it is, so you have to go in and crack them. So they learn to give them to them without the shell. So they learn what they are. So when they have the shell and the shell's cracked, they can smell the nut and see the nut, and they learn that inside that hard package is something good to eat.
Well,
so it does take us more of a challenge to come up with things to teach them what they have to know without the human interaction.
Well, walnut is one thing, but when it comes to fishing or cracking open a log, that's something that a human can't reasonably show him how to do. And
sure,
given
that's
his age...
That's a natural thing to a bear. And if you put a rotten log, which we do, in their cage, and we stuff it full of grubs and interesting things, and then present it to the bear, he instinctively will go after it, and he will find the food and get a reward. And then that reward teaches them that rotten logs have grubs in them for them to eat. And at Yosemite this year, when they filmed the cubs coming out of hibernation, the first thing those cubs did was go to a rotten log and rip it up. So obviously they learned their lesson well. Fish is always presented to them in water, so they know they take it out when they eat it, but they know that fish is in water. They're a very thinking animal. They're not a dumb animal. They're very, that's why they're so smart, and they break into houses when they see a refrigerator.
How do you choose where to put the bear when it's time for hibernating?
I don't, sir. It's up to a call on Fish and Game.
So the California Department of Fish and Game makes that call?
I believe it's within 10 miles of where they're picked up. Unless Little Smokey's whole area has been burned, then they'll come up with something else. But that's their call.
Now, what if Little Smokey can't go back to the wild if his pads and claws don't grow back enough?
Well, there are three sanctuaries for bears that have said that they would be very willing to take him if it doesn't, but we're not even considering that. That's a long ways down the road.
How many of the animals and birds that you receive actually do manage to return to the wild? Is there a typical percentage?
I think something like 85-95%. The other ones that come to us are so badly mauled by cats and dogs or injured by cars that we can't return them to the wild, and then they can go to educational facilities and breeding facilities if they're an endangered species. But our main goal is to get everything back where it belongs, living a normal life that it would live in the wild.
Dr. Kevin Willits, you inspected Lil Smokey yesterday. How little is he now? Has he put on weight?
Oh, he's put on quite a bit of weight. He came in at, I think, 8 pounds, and he's close to 15 or a little over 15 now. So in his first 6 months, he only weighed, well, he probably weighed more when he was in better shape. He lost a little bit through his trials and tribulations, but here, obviously, he's getting a regular diet, and so he's put on quite a bit of weight, and it would be fully expected for him to get back up to what's normal, and we're seeing the bears from this year's litter up around the 30 to 40-pound range at this point. So
that's what he should be?
That's what he should be. But they're adaptable. Depends on the food sources, and maybe mom has more than one cub to feed. And so it's not unusual to see them at different weight levels through the spring and summer.
How old is he?
He's probably about 6 months, 7 months, somewhere in January, February he was probably born.
Would he still be living with his mother if he was in the wild?
Absolutely.
And we don't know what happened to his mother. All we know is presumably she was in the same wildfire where he was found.
We'd have to assume that. Yeah. But no, there hasn't been any reports of a female in that area, and there wasn't at the time.
And what condition was he in when you first inspected him?
Well, he was dehydrated and somewhat shocky. They did what they could for him, and primarily burns to his feet. He has a little singeing around one eye, which is healing great, and the tips of his ears, which are healing really well. It's just that most of the trauma occurred on his feet, and that's even though it wasn't a significant portion of his body, it's still a vital portion of his body, and and that's what we're wrestling with.
We talked earlier about you using honey and other treatments on his burned paws. A listener who identified himself as Chris called a little while ago and said that he used vinegar to treat burns and wounds when he was young. I'd never heard of such a thing. Have you heard of such a thing?
Well, we've actually been getting a lot of calls and emails from people who have used different things on burns, and we're kind of going by the book on this one. We're trying to not experiment if we don't have to, and we're actually past the point of the real burn. We're dealing with the middle healing stages, and we're seeing enough progress that I don't think we're going to make any radical changes.
Okay. And finally, Cheryl Milham, why was this bear cub given the name Little Smokey? I would have thought that usually nicknames were not given to wild creatures that are taken in with the view to reintroducing them to the wild, just so that people don't bond with them too much.
Well, actually, you're very right. We don't name them. We call the one cub came from Yosemite, so that's the Yosemite cub, because when we have to do testing on them and their blood is drawn, the vet has to be able to identify what cub it is. So they're given names usually from where they come from. There's the Grass Valley cub, the Yosemite cub, the Alpine cub. And I got a call the day that Little Smokey was picked up by Mr. Deem, and his wife said, well, my husband named him Little Smokey, and I think you should keep that name since he's the one that saved his life. And I really didn't care, because you're right, we don't name him here. But we had to name him something for identification purposes, so she was quite adamant about naming him, keeping the name that her husband called him.
Very
so
good.
I said, sure.
Well, thank you so much. That's Cheryl Milham, founder and executive director of Lake Tahoe Wildlife Care, the South Lake Tahoe organization that's caring for the bear cub nicknamed Little Smokey, and Dr. Kevin Willits, the veterinarian who's caring for the cub. And that's that. Well, thank you both very much for joining us.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
You're listening to Insight from KXJZ. Coming up, a book about ethnic cleansing in California during the gold rush. We'll be right back. You're listening to Insight from KXJZ. I'm Jeffrey Callison. We welcome your suggestions of topics and guests on Insight. Send them to insight@capradio.org. Sacramento has lost hundreds of rooms for the borderline homeless. Some local MBA students are trying to help. Monday on Insight, you'll hear about their proposed design for a green building that would house dozens of very low-income people. Also, an interview with the new director of the Lake Tahoe Shakespeare Festival. And financial distress at Nevada City's Foothill Theatre Company. It's at risk of closing down. Some of our listeners got fired up by one of yesterday's topics. We were talking about algebra, specifically the recent controversial decision by the California Board of Education to test all 8th graders in Algebra 1. Joining me to read from some emails is Insight's Robin Souza. Robin, hello.
Hi, Jeffrey.
Well, let's start with one listener who emailed to say that algebra is fine, but not essential.
Well, this is from Ralph from Davis, who says, encouraging higher level math skills is definitely a worthy objective, but but our republic will not fall if every one of its citizens is not algebra proficient. Algebra should be an option, but shouldn't be force-fed. Students unable to learn algebra should not be penalized or hindered in their pursuit of educational goals that do not require higher math skills.
Another listener looked back into his own math history to question whether eighth grade is actually the right time to evaluate algebra skills.
And that's David from Roseville, who writes, "As a high school honors student, I received a D my freshman year in high school when I took Algebra 1, yet went on to later earn a degree in mathematics from UC Berkeley. It wasn't until I was in college that things clicked and I began to excel at the subject. Why are we assuming that all kids will have the same mathematical maturity at the same age?"
But Lisa from Sparks had a different perspective.
Rubbish. Eighth graders or even seventh graders are not inherently incapable of dealing with algebra. European children coped with it perfectly well in the late 1960s and early 70s. Algebra is not hard, nor does it take any unique, developed mental capacity or maturity.
That's Robin Souza. Thanks, Robin.
You're welcome. Thank you, Jeffrey.
I also got a call from a listener who took the algebra test that's on the webpage for yesterday's show. He noted a typo, which we were already aware of and which has been fixed. The answers to the three questions are also posted. And finally, on the subject of yesterday's show, you weren't imagining it if you thought you heard about 6 seconds of conversation at the end between me and Insight's Jen Picard, if you thought you heard it repeated. A technical issue too tedious to describe indirectly caused a hiccup in our delay system. We have a 10-second delay just in case Bono or Janet Jackson is on the show and we need to delete something that slips out. Basically, our conversation was just so good, the computer went back 6 seconds to hear it again. The gold rush in California and the Pacific Northwest was a tough and even dangerous time for Chinese and Chinese Americans. Along with discrimination of all kinds, there were killings that we would now probably call hate crimes or even ethnic purging. The story is told in the book Driven Out, which is now out in paperback. The author, Jean Falzer, joins us. Jean, welcome to Insight.
Hi, thank you.
Well, your book is subtitled The Forgotten War Against Chinese Americans. Why did you choose the word war to describe the conflict between European Americans and Chinese Americans in the Gold Rush?
I think one of the things that hasn't been known about the anti-Chinese violence was how much the Chinese fought back, that the Chinese who were rounded up and driven out of towns from Seattle, Tacoma, Portland, Eureka, Truckee, down to Los Angeles, Riverside, and East, fought back every time something came down on them as a people. And so it was a sense not of people being on the receiving end of racial violence, but people very forcefully resisting what was coming down on them.
Who was opposing the Chinese, and why were they opposed to the Chinese?
Well, there are many explanations of why the Chinese were rounded up. This was a very racist time in California. It was a hard time economically, and so although there was more work than people to do the work, the myth was set up that Chinese people, Chinese immigrants, the first Chinese Americans, were taking jobs from white people. In the years following the Civil War, the racism of the South moves into California. The Southern Democrats take over the governor's mansion. They have control of the state legislature. And they bring with them a lot of ideas about race and transplant them from African Americans to Chinese people, ideas about citizenship, ideas about sexuality, become moved from African Americans onto the Chinese people. And of course, this is the period in the West when Native Americans were being rounded up and driven off of their lands. It's later in the West than in the East. So there's a model out there, a template for the mass removal of people.
You said that the Gold Rush was a racist time, and at that time, people from all over the world were coming to California. Did the Chinese get it worse? And if so, why the Chinese as opposed to all manner of other ethnic and racial groups?
Well, the driven out, the roundups, actually just start with the Gold Rush, and they go through the turn of the century. The first miners onto the gold fields were Chileans and Argentinians and Mexicans. And the white people actually design laws against the Latinos, and they work, and they're able to drive the Mexicans and the Chileans out of the mines. And then within a few months when the Chinese people arrive, these policies are available, they're in place, and they just apply them to the Chinese people. So it was a very global form of race.
My guest is Jean Falzer, author of Driven Out, The Forgotten War Against Chinese Americans. It's a book about the discrimination against and the ethnic purging of Chinese and Chinese Americans in California and the Pacific Northwest during the Gold Rush. She's also professor of English and American Studies at the University of Delaware, but is originally from Northern California. What, in your opinion, was the worst incident in this war against Chinese Americans, as it's called in the title of your book, in the Gold Rush era in California and the Pacific Northwest?
I think there were episodes that were very harsh because they were total. Over 1,500 Chinese Americans were driven out of Truckee, and Truckee was very nervous about the violence done to the Chinese people, and so the editor of the Truckee Republican decides to starve them out, and it takes 10 weeks. And night after night on the train leaving Truckee, 10, 50, 100 people get on the train and are destitute. They're hungry. Some well-intended butchers have left little packets of meat along the trails for the Chinese people because they weren't allowed to use buggies. They weren't allowed to hold jobs. They weren't allowed to talk with any white people. So the Truckee episode, I think, was very painful. In Los Angeles, there were lynchings of Chinese people. In 1871, 17 Chinese men and 2 Chinese women are lynched in downtown Los Angeles in a race riot. And so that was quite blatant racial violence. They're hung from the posts of buggies and from gateways, and they're cut down the next morning.
When would you say that this period ended, and what caused it to end?
The last roundups happened up in Northern California in 1906, when the Chinese had been purged from Humboldt County, and 20 Chinese people come back to work in the canneries. And very quickly, there's a cry, the Chinese are back, the Chinese are back. And they're rounded up from the cannery along the Eel River. And they're kept on an island called Indian Island. And it was called that because it was the site of the massacre of the Wiat tribe in 1861. This time, the Chinese refuse to leave until they've been paid for a whole season's work. And while they're raising the money to buy out their contracts, they're kept on Indian Island in boxcars. And that's the last roundup, the last major roundup in 1906. In 1910, they open Angel Island, the detention center in San Francisco Bay. And so there's a lot of screening and returning and deportations that happen through Angel Island.
So Angel Island was for deportations as well as people coming in?
Absolutely. Many people didn't make it. Many Chinese people spent 2 to 3 years on Angel Island waiting to be processed. Some just gave up and went back to China. It doesn't really end until 1943. And it's not till then that Chinese people are allowed to legally enter the United States. We're at war with Japan, China's at war with Japan, and sort of as a sop to our ally, they end the Chinese Exclusion Acts. The Chinese Exclusion Acts are the only immigration laws that ever targeted a particular race. And those end in 1943, and the government allows 130 3 Chinese mm-hmm. people to enter the country each year.
My guest is Gene Falzer, author of Driven Out. It's now out in paperback. What got you interested in the subject? Do you have a personal connection to it?
I do. In the 1970s, 1974, when I was finishing my thesis, I took a job up in Northern California at Humboldt State University. And as I looked around my classroom at this very unusual university with a large mix of white students and Native American students, having grown up in California, I looked around and there were no Asian kids. And when I started to ask, where are our Asian students? People told me, well, at first nobody had noticed, and then nobody had an answer. And then a local poet said, well, Chinese Americans won't send their kids to Humboldt State because 100 years ago they were driven out. And I felt, as somebody who loves Humboldt County and Northern California, that this was something I needed to look into. At first, I thought it was going to be the story of Eureka, of one town. And I didn't expect to discover the first day I was reading the 19th century newspapers that there goes Truckee, there goes Stockton, there goes Los Angeles, there goes Fresno, and on until there were 300 towns.
You said you described yourself as someone who loves Humboldt County, and I understand that you spend part of your summers in a family cabin in Humboldt County.
Yes, I'm there now.
Yes. Do you feel like that 100-year-old incident has healed?
I think there are very few Asian kids still and at Humboldt State. When I talk about it up at Humboldt or in the towns around here, there's tremendous interest because many Chinese people will come to the area and presume that there'll be an Asian American community here. And it's very small, and oftentimes it's transient, where there isn't a core community here, but there wasn't really an explanation of why there was this sort of invisibility.
Mm-hmm. Gene, you're a professor of English and American Studies at the University of Delaware, but I note that your fields include utopian studies, and I'm wondering what that means and how it connects to this work that you've done on the Chinese Americans and the Gold Rush, if it does connect.
Well, I think I'm by nature a very optimistic person, and I probably have a bit of a rebel spirit in me as well. The connection that was interesting for me, and actually I think was a surprise historically, was how much resistance there was to the roundups. The Chinese bought arms from China. In many places, they refused to leave. They did local gestures like they would return laundry in a town where they were being attacked. They would return laundry folded but still dirty. They organized the first vegetable boycotts in California. The first farm worker strikes in California were organized by Chinese Americans. And so I found it a very high-spirited and resilient story of an organized community determined to fight the violence coming against them.
I see. Gene Falzer, author of Driven Out, The Forgotten War Against Chinese Americans, a book about the discrimination against and the ethnic purging of Chinese and Chinese Americans in California and the Pacific Northwest during the Gold Rush. He also is a professor at the University of Delaware. Gene, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
You're listening to Insight from KXJZ. Coming up, two local women preparing to swim to Catalina Island and a local man preparing to swim the English Channel. We'll be right back. You're listening to Insight from KXJZ. I'm Jeffrey Callison. If you missed a previous Insight, it's okay. Check out our archives at capradio.org/insight. Coming up this afternoon from KXJZ News, California's biggest state worker union tries to stop the layoffs of thousands of seasonal and part-time employees. The SEIU has filed a lawsuit to try and block Governor Schwarzenegger's executive order laying off workers because of the lack of a new state budget. That story is later today on All Things Considered. Three locals are preparing to do two of the world's great swims this summer, Long Beach to Catalina and the English Channel. They're all in our studio to explain how and why they're doing this. The Catalina swimmers are Emily Evans and Kate Howell of Davis. The English Channel swimmer is Jack Couts of Lodi. Emily, Kate, Jack, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much.
Emily, we'll start with you because you've actually been on the program before. We spoke with you last year when you were about to do the Alcatraz swim. And I've got to ask you, why are you doing the Long Beach to Catalina Island? Because as big a deal as Alcatraz swim is, this is a much bigger deal. Why are you doing it?
Well, actually, my whole reason for getting into open water swimming was to someday eventually conquer the Catalina Channel. It was an idea that my dad brought up to me in 1995, and that was kind of the impetus for me to getting out in open water and out of the pool. And Alcatraz was just kind of a step on the way.
Just a step in the way, my goodness. You said conquer the channel. You're fired up here.
Definitely fired up. It's a big challenge. I think that's one of the primary motivations to do something like this. You know, there's obviously just the enjoyment of physically being in the water, but there's definitely this mental stimulation of picking a challenge and then conquering it.
Must be very physically demanding.
Very physically demanding. Yeah, a lot of training.
Can you compare it to anything?
Well, all three of us have been involved in a lot of endurance events, but I feel... For me, this is probably the biggest physical challenge that I'll have put my body through. We've done, you know, a lot of long triathlons, marathons, and things like that. But the idea of being in the water for, you know, 10 to 14 hours, doing the same type of activity will be very challenging.
Kate Howell, it's got to be dangerous or potentially dangerous.
Let's hope not.
Have you thought about that? I mean, what are the dangers?
Well, actually, ironically, Emily has suffered all the dangers for us so far. She got stung by a stingray and a jellyfish. So that's what we've encountered so far.
Where did that happen?
The stingray was in Seal Beach and down in Long Beach. And then the jellyfish was in the bay. I guess there's also sharks, of course, and seals. Seals apparently like to nibble swimmers' toes sometimes, but we haven't had too much problems.
Is there anything you can do to keep the stingrays, the jellyfish, and so on away? Or you just have to cross your fingers, but not too much because you're swimming?
Yeah, not too much. There's the stingray shuffle. You walk dragging your feet to hopefully scare them, but... We were actually doing just that when Emily got stung, so now I'm not so sure how effective that is. And the jellyfish, Jack was saying he ran into one the other day. I guess you run into them because you're not looking forward, you're looking down. So things that are in front of you, you have the potential to just run into. And when you run into them, you just have to stay calm and then stop and swim around them.
So Emily, you were stung off Long Beach?
Yeah, as we were walking into the water, it was we were taking our last swim before we were heading home to Davis, and as we were walking in the water, one of them got me on my foot, and the lifeguards there actually told us that 20 to 30 people get stung a day at that beach.
So you wanted to actually try out the water at Long Beach? Is there something different about the water there?
There's salt in it.
Yeah, well, it is hard to be trying to train for a channel swim when you live in the Central Valley, so I think all three of us have done what we can to be near the ocean when possible.
Emily Evans and Kate Howell are preparing to swim from Long Beach to Catalina Island next week. Jack Couts is planning to swim the English Channel later this summer. Jack, why are you planning to do this?
It's a challenge. To me, I've always loved swimming. And as far as the swimming events along with Catalina, it's one of the toughest swims I think you could do. And it's just to mark it off my list. I'm really excited to try it and complete it and then move on from there.
Kate said that the Long Beach to Catalina Island swim will probably take them 10 to 14 hours. What's ahead of you swimming across the English Channel?
I would love to make it in 12. My goal is between 12 and 20. It really depends. You know, it's up to 6 tide changes and weather conditions, so on and so on. My goal, though, is 12 to 20.
12 to 20, that's a big range. You know, typically when you speak to marathon runners, for example, they have a much smaller range that they're expecting. is that typical for open water swimming to have this huge range that you're expecting?
Yeah, I think especially in my case, I've never really been over 12 miles before. And I don't quite know what to expect. I don't know nutrition-wise how my body's going to handle that, how my body's going to handle the cold water, and so many other factors involved. But the one thing I do know is mentally I will make it. You know, just physically, I hope my body holds up.
Yeah. Another thing with other sports, there's not these environmental factors that are highly variable and take such, you know, make a swim be either 10 or 20 hours, you know. I'm sure that Jack is totally capable speed-wise and capabilities to do it in 12, but if the tides are wrong and the waves are big and he's cold and all these other things, then that is what just makes it get longer and longer. Yes. And longer.
Now, I'm actually told that the Catalina swim is from Catalina to Long Beach. Is that right?
Yes, sir.
So yeah. You have to get to Catalina first. How are you getting there?
Oh, we're going to swim over first. No. We have boats that we have. There are escort boats that we've rented. They're big fishing boats.
You have escort boats. You're required to have the boats?
Yeah. We go through a Catalina Channel Swimming Federation, and they have an official observer on board. They're usually fishing boats, and they require you to have them as assistants, and they kind of certify the boats to make sure that they know how to take a swimmer across.
Can you share a boat?
If I was faster, yes. I'm a little bit slower than Emily, so we each have our own boats, so they can go at each of our own speeds.
Wow, what does it cost to rent a boat like that? Is this a difficult question?
No, they're a little bit different. Emily's includes breakfast, but hers is a set price, whereas mine is $18.50 for the first 9 hours, and then each hour thereafter is $150. So I guess a good incentive to really pick it up at the end.
I'm guessing that all told, it's kind of expensive.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. Something that we've been saving for. Yeah.
Definitely.
Now, Jack, what about you? I'm guessing this is going to be even more expensive for you to do the English Channel swim.
I'm thinking ballpark it's going to probably be close to
$15,000. Whoa.
What?
By the time... I hope my dad didn't hear that. No, by the time you pay for your flights, and I have to pay for two other people, and your hotel for 15 days. I'm actually going for 15 days.
You have to pay for two other people?
Two other people. Support swimmer, and one of the incentives for him to go was, you know, I'd pick up his plane fare. And one of the persons going to help me with feedings. Feedings are when they pass you your nutritional supplements.
So what kind of things will you be actually consuming when you're swimming?
Kate's probably a better one to ask about this. Myself, it's going to be a lot the same lines as an Ironman. Cytomax, goo packets, muscle milk. And I started getting these cravings for jelly beans.
And do you actually have to stop swimming with one of your arms to put this in your mouth, or do your assistants somehow feed you?
You can't touch anything. And if they have a bottle and a rope that they throw out, if the rope goes tight, technically that disqualifies you from the swim.
Oh my goodness!
And so usually they throw you something, you float over in your back and roll over in your back, and
just like an otter.
That way, just like an otter. Yeah, I hope I swim like an otter.
And Emily and Kate, what about you? What are you going to be consuming, if that's the best word to use?
Yeah, I'm probably going to go all liquid. It's a drink called Perpetuum, just something that I've been training with, same kind of thing, and maybe some of that chocolate goo because I like chocolate.
Yeah, and Kate.
It's the same brand as Emily's Perpetuum, which is called Sustained Energy. And I like to eat a little more than Emily does, so I've been fantasizing, I don't know, Fig Newtons, really soft bread. I don't know. I need to sort out what can handle being.
But won't your mom say you'll get cramps in the water?
Hopefully not. Hopefully she'll be saying nicer things than that. Like, keep it up. You can do it. But I don't know. We'll see.
With Kate Howell and Emily Evans, they're going to swim from Catalina to Long Beach next Wednesday. And Jack Couts is going to swim the English Channel later this summer. Jack, you mentioned a couple of the specific rules here. Anything else that you need to keep in your mind when you're doing the swim to make sure you're not disqualified? You can't touch the people on the boat or the boat.
You can't touch anything. And the support swimmer, if you do have one, you can have a support swimmer 1 hour every 4 hours. And he can't get in front of you at all because they call it drafting. And when you finally do hit France, you have to walk up to the high water mark and then come back to the water. If you don't walk up to the high water mark and faint for whatever reason, because you're right at the end, technically they can disqualify you also.
Goodness. And Emily and Kate, what about you? What rules do you have to follow?
We have similar rules. They're a little bit more lenient. We're allowed to have a kayaker in the water with us, so we'll have kayakers. And we can have support swimmers whenever we want. But the same idea, they have to be behind us. We're not allowed to draft off them.
Yeah. Jack, earlier Kate talked about stingrays, jellyfish, possible sharks, and so on. Are all of those potential challenges for you in the English Channel? Or is the wildlife different?
I've convinced myself there's no sharks over in the English Channel. We've been having this debate. No, mine's nice. We'll be little tropical fish. We'll be floating around. I don't know what to expect. The worst part, my biggest fear, is jumping in the dark. I'm going to have about 3 hours swim in the dark, which Emily and Kate haven't mentioned yet, but they have to jump in at 11 o'clock at night.
Why at night?
Ideally, so the tides are right and the sea is calm, and also we don't get run over by boat traffic because we are swimming in a channel where they carry the big freighters and everything.
So despite what it sounds like, it's actually meant to make it easier.
Yes, correct. Ideally, although
but
it
still,
is quite frightening.
That must be. That's going to be spooky, isn't it?
It's a little spooky. The one upside of it is there's this beautiful phosphorescence. So any motion in the water creates a kind of glow. So that part's kind of cool to see this glow around your hands.
Yeah, and don't they also off Catalina have these fish that jump out of the water and they're sort of sparkly?
The flying fish.
Yeah, I've seen them.
Those make us afraid.
Yeah, we're hoping they'll hit the kayaker more than they'll hit us is what we're hoping for.
And Jack, you're not looking forward to the dark either.
No, not at all. Not at all.
Because, I mean, it's natural for humans to be a little afraid of the dark, but is it worse because you're in open water and it's dark?
I believe so. Never know what's underneath you. You know, swimming in San Francisco Bay, you can't actually see underneath you either, but at least you can see around you in the dark. It's just that the fear of the unknown.
The waters off California are colder than people think. What about the English Channel? Is it the same temperature or is it colder?
It's probably looking at 58 to 62 degrees.
And what
so it's about equivalent right now to San Francisco Bay.
I see. So even though it's a lot further north, it's actually no colder.
Exactly.
I see. Well, this is really quite a big deal. Briefly, have you thought about what's next? I mean, what can you do after Catalina, Emily and Kate, the English Channel?
I think we're moving to a different sport. We've been talking about a 50K trail run, so
dry out for a little while.
Yeah.
Dry out for a little while. And what about you, Jack? Is there anything, what could you do after the English Channel?
Well, I'd love to climb the seven summits. I've done Kilimanjaro so far, and hopefully Denali later this year. At least get the easy ones out of the way. Firewalking, that kind of came up. Just whatever. There's different challenges and dog sledding in North Pole. I want to try that.
The Iditarod?
Yeah, and then ski around the North Pole.
So you're all looking at non-watery challenges, I guess, next.
Oh, we're not going to leave the water anytime soon.
No.
Absolutely not. Swimming is a love.
You might.
We're hoping to do Trans Tahoe next summer. Solo Trans Tahoe next summer. That's shorter.
Well, good luck to you all. Emily Evans and Kate Howell of Davis are going to be swimming from Catalina Island to Long Beach next week on Wednesday. And Jack Couts of Lodi is going to swim the English Channel in early September. Good luck to you all. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
And that's Insight for today. I'm Jeffrey Callison. For more information about the guests and topics you hear on Insight, go to our webpage, capradio.org/insight. Coming up on KXJZ, Walmart is denying a Wall Street Journal story that says it tried to persuade thousands of managers and department heads to vote Republican in the next election in order to help head off pressure from unions. That's coming up in Marketplace. Insight's theme was composed by Joe Gilman and Paul Conley. Today's associate producer, Ellie Fox. Insight's technical director is Mark Jones. The assistant producer, Robin Souza. The senior producer, Jen Picard. Insight's executive producer is Carl Watanabe. And thank you for joining us. Has lost hundreds of rooms for the borderline homeless. Some local MBA students are trying to help. On the next Insight, hear about a proposed design for a green building that would house dozens of low-income people. Also, Foothill Theatre Company in danger of closing after 32 years. And you'll meet the new artistic director of the Lake Tahoe Shakespeare Festival. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Join me for Insight.
That's Monday at 2 on KXJZ.